Hey everybody, this is Paul Brandt.
This is Wayne Peters.
This is Sean Baker.
I'm Megan Murphy.
This is Jess Moskaluk.
I'm Rupa Subramania.
This is Sheila Gunn-Reed, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Wednesday, hump day. And yes, I am still here. Man, the panic that went up on the phone line. I love you all. Like, I mean, everybody was just freaking out, and rightfully so. I woke up to just a handful of texts on the phone saying, you know, your show was not on Spotify. So if you don't listen to Spotify, you had no idea this happened. But on Spotify, the entire channel was gone. And so you can imagine everybody, including myself, started to go, what's going on? And it took a little bit to get to the bottom of it. But, you know, who knows? Maybe something more nefarious was going on, or maybe it was just simply a technical glitch. Either way, after I got through to the channels that be, within a couple hours, it was back up. Everything was back up. So I don't know. Is that an RSS feed, folks? Maybe that's what it is. I'm not 100% sure. Either way, we're going nowhere. We are still here. And if you were a fan of the Tuesday mashup, I'm sorry for your Tuesday morning being thrown a curveball. There was a lot of people a little bit upset that their Tuesday wasn't starting the right way. Anyways, let's get on to today's episode sponsors. We got a good one on tap for you today. Maybe a great one. I always enjoy when these two come on and get going off each other. You know, I call it riffing, you know, and they're playing back and forth. Like, it's just, you just sit there and you listen to these two go, and we certainly do. Today's sponsors, Guardian Plumbing and Heating. Go back to episode 337, and you get Blaine and Joy Steffen, the owners of Guardian Plumbing and Heating. And well, they need guys. They're looking. I actually just had somebody text me asking who this was. Well, what makes them different is their service team works a 7 days on, 7 days off schedule, 12-hour shifts, no night shift, no on call. So basically, you work for half the month, but get paid for the whole thing. They also offer traditional 5 and 2 schedules for their installers. They got great benefits, awesome wages, great team, and are looking for plumbers, HVAC techs, installers, and apprentices. For more information, guardianplumbing.ca, where you can schedule your next appointment at any time. The Deer and Steer Butchery on Highway 16, Range Road 25. That's the old Norman and Kathy James family-built butcher shop, which has had a facelift. And wouldn't you know it, they're looking for people, too. They're wondering if there's a butcher hiding out in Alberta, Saskatchewan, maybe right across this great country that's looking for a change of pace, a change of scenery, an opportunity. You get the point. If you fit the bill, maybe you're looking to get into the career, 780-870-8700. Give the Deer and Steer a call as they're full out. And if you got an animal that needs butchered, well, once again, you got the number. Give them a call. Eggland, they started back in 1957 as a John Deere equipment dealer with a staff of 6. Today, 60-plus years of business later, 3 locations, Lloydminster, Vermilion, St. Paul, with a staff of 130. They sell and service John Deere, Brent, Bobcat, Dangleman, AA trailers. And if you need more information, oh, that was weird. Need more information? Need more info. That sounded weird. Agland.ca to check out their full inventory. Jim Spanrath and the team, as a restaurant here in town, I'm trying to think of another one. I think of Fourth Meridian Brewery has their karaoke night, but I can't think of an actual restaurant that brings in live music, and I apologize, maybe there is. But the team, Jim Spanrath and the team over at Three Trees Tap and Kitchen, has been bringing in different acts, you know, usually about once a month. If you follow them on social media, you can get the latest, greatest of when they got people coming in, who's coming in. They did their Three Trees treasure hunt recently, and all you got to do is go on social media to follow along. If you're going there, and it's going to take the missus, or maybe Mr., for a date night, I suggest calling in advance, getting a reservation, 780-874-7625. Gartner Management, they're a Lloydminster-based company, specialize in all types of rental properties to help meet your needs. Whether you're looking for a small office or maybe you got multiple employees, give away to Gartner a call, 780-808-5025. So now let's get on to that tail of the tape. I don't know why that came out so weird. Here we are. It's brought to you by Hancock Petroleum. For the past 80 years, they've been an industry leader in bulk fuels, lubricants, methanol, and chemicals, delivering to your farm, commercial, or oil field locations. For more information, visit them at hancockpetroleum.ca. The first is a former research chemist. amateur dairy goat farmer, libertarian, and economist whose work can be found on sites like Zero Hedge and Newsmax Media. The second, a Croatian national, former hedge fund manager, author, and contributing editor at Zero Hedge. I'm talking about Tom Luongo and Alex Craner. So buckle up, here we go.
I'm Alex Craner, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Alex Craner, Tom Luongo. Listeners will recall, Tom was on episode 321, Alex on 327, and then you guys were on together 336, and that was November 2nd. And I chuckle, you know, here we are a little less than a month after, and I feel like everything in the world just is constantly changing and everything else. Either way, boys, thanks for hopping back on. I got tons of great feedback on every episode you two had been on, but especially putting you two together, it was very popular. People really enjoyed it. So thanks for hopping back on here.
Happy to do it.
Greg, good to be with you, Sean. Hi, Tom. Good to see you again.
As always. Alex, it's my pleasure.
Excited about the discussion that hasn't happened yet.
Well,
before we get into it,
wouldn't it be fun to do this live? You know, like in person somewhere at a pub or something.
Would you two like to come to Western Canada? We could do an SMP Presents. I'd gladly host the two of you on stage talking.
Yeah, I mean, if we can work it out, it'd be fun.
There you go.
I'm not averse. So as long as we. Oh, so where are you actually, Sean?
Well, I could probably fly into Calgary. Is probably where we.
Okay,
try
so
and
that
do
means
it.
A Flames game would have to be in the.
Oh, I gotta work out a Flames game too. I do you realize I mean, I'm a diehard
dude? If I'm doing Alberta, then it's, you know, I'm definitely doing both a Flames game and an Oilers game. Like it's you know, I'm agnostic about this. I just have to go and visit all the Canadian shrines.
You know, I was saying to the listener, we've been chatting now for like 10 minutes about nothing, about how Tom is microwaving his coffee and everything else. And everybody's just, I tell you what, I apologize to the listener because there will be a bloopers reel come out. Just not this one. The next time I have these two Yahoos on, I'm going to make sure I record right from the beginning because I've been doing nothing but laughing my ass off since we started. And we haven't even talked about anything. Now,
pretty much.
The world is alive right now, or the Twitter is electric right now with everything. Yes. China. We're seeing massive protests. Where do you guys want to start with this? I'll throw it whichever way you want to go. Whoever wants to hop in first. I look at it and I go like, you know, from the Canadian side, we're with China now, but we weren't with our own people when we were protesting. I find that comical. But I mean, China looks like this bizarro land right now. What are you guys seeing? What are you hearing?
Alex, why don't you take this first?
Okay. So, Sean, I don't know about China. I've been forming my opinions about what's going on in China over the last 2 years with the pandemic. But I don't know, because I know that the West is flush with disinformation and misinformation about China. Right. So a lot of it is coming through the Epoch Times. You know, journalists are quoting Epoch Times at face value. Epoch Times is controlled by the thing called Falun Gong, which is extremely anti-Chinese Communist Party, but, you know, the right. current regime. So I trust them as far as I can throw them, which is not extremely far. I've been trying to follow actual, genuine, authentic Chinese sources, and several Westerners who live in China. And what I'm gathering from them is that things are not at all the way it's being presented in the Western media.
Okay.
What the hell is going on with this zero COVID policy? I don't know, but it isn't about COVID, that's for sure, because to push on with a zero COVID policy, you would have to be stupid, or you'd have to have a different agenda. And I don't know what the different agenda is, but I'll just mention what I worked out the Russian agenda was with COVID. I may have mentioned this before, but I think it's worth keeping in mind, because I was personally very surprised to see Russia fall into lockstep with the World Health Organization and Bill Gates and everybody, and take this COVID thing at face value seriously, do the lockdowns, the masks, the vaccination, everything as the World Health Organization dictated. I was very confused about it because, you know, you already had the president of Belarus, Lukashenko, who pretty much said, this is all bullshit. We're not doing this. And, you know, I know that at the level of intelligence services, Russia and Belarus are quite tight. So what was the Russian game? And then I kind of, it became clear to me the day they announced that they are launching their Sputnik V vaccine. Because Sputnik V vaccine was the first one to launch in the whole world, right? The Russians were the first. And they made the vaccine immediately available to the whole world, whoever wanted it. They were going to give it to them at low prices. And not only that, they also offered countries to produce their own version under license. So they said, we'll give you the license if you want to produce it yourself. Okay, so here's where the game it gets interesting. The vaccines themselves are secondary. The thing that was more important was that the vaccine was supposed to be the stepping stone towards the sanitary passes, the COVID passports, which were supposed to be universal. And now if you look at the statements by people like Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates and so forth, they fully planned on having monopoly on the vaccines. So Western pharmaceutical corporations were going to have the monopoly, and they were going to vaccinate 7 billion people. Remember Bill Gates saying, like, yes, nothing's going to normal, back to normal until we have 7 billion people vaccinated.
Yep.
So that means that 7 billion people would obtain vaccination certificate linked to Moderna, Pfizer, Novartis, whatever else came out. And so that means now the next level is important because, you know, once you have a vaccine certificate, there's a whole administration and bureaucracy that is behind, you know, when you show your QR code and then some machine says go or don't or stop.
Right.
There's a whole bureaucracy, IT system and administration of these rules, right? And so monopoly over the vaccines would also give them the monopoly over the administration of this system.
Yes.
Now, if countries adopted Sputnik V, the Russian vaccine, that completely throws the spanner into the globalist pandemic agenda, because now they either have to include Russians in the administration of this system, or they have to give up control over the countries that opt for Sputnik V, you know, because now you cannot, now you no longer have monopoly. Now, what the hell do you do now? So had the Russians not played along and taken the whole thing seriously, and, you know, if they said, like, no, we're not buying this, this is a hoax, then their vaccine wouldn't have been credible. Who, you know, like, wait, yes, you have a vaccine, but you said the whole thing was a hoax. So the Russians had to play along,
yes,
be part of the system in order to throw a spanner into it. Because, you know, it's not just whether you or I can get on a plane or go into a pub or go into a theater. It's much bigger than that, because that system you could use it to destabilize government. You could use it to trigger social uprisings. You know, you could use it in all kinds of nefarious ways once you have the power to control whether in some countries people may travel, people may leave their homes, people may, yep, you know, go to work, children may go to school, and so on and so forth. And so the globalists fully planned on holding all the cards and having full control over this system. And the fact that the Russians played along, launched their vaccine first, completely collapsed this agenda. So
yeah,
that's how we work out the Russian agenda. I don't know how to work out the Chinese agenda. It's like way out there. Way out there in the sense that it's so exaggerated, way past due date, right, that there's got to be something to it. I just can't explain what it is. My guess is that they're maybe shaking out foreigners out of China, yeah, because we've seen that this is such heavy-handed harassment that I know people who have said, like, okay, enough, we're packing up, we're leaving China, we're not going to live here anymore.
You're maybe right about that, Alex. What's interesting,
yeah, so I don't have a different explanation, but it's not zero COVID, because zero COVID is a completely unrealistic, impossible objective.
Agreed.
So to do all this to eliminate a virus which cannot be eliminated is simply not the correct explanation.
Well, and I want to fill in some stuff that Alex said about the Russian thing, because I hadn't, that explanation is really good. And I remember the day that Sputnik 5 was announced, I called it the biggest geopolitical tool available. I wrote about it. There's a blog. I got a blog post on Sputnik 5, all of it, because I realized exactly what it was. It was a means by which for the Russians to shift the entire process and to put themselves, I always thought it was to put themselves in a magnanimous position. It's like, we have a simple two-vector adenovirus vaccine, which is no different than, you know, the one they developed for SARS, MERS, Ebola, because, I mean, these are all, you know, coronavirus variants in some way, right? So the technology was proven, it was easy to generate, and the potential for there to be side effects of the type that we've seen with the mRNA viruses vaccines, were much lower because of it. I remember arguing literally with a friend of mine who is a virologist about this, and because he was going on and on and on about, you know, the Russian virus, the Russian vaccine is no different. I'm like, no, it isn't. I've read the papers on this. I've read this, and since I also have a science background, he actually listens to it. And we had a long talk about this, and it really like stopped him for a minute. I'm like, no, the Russian vaccine is different, and it's different for a reason. And Alex, the point you make about Russians having to go along with it, and then you know, get the adenovirus vector vaccine out into the hands of billions of people, and for the West to completely reject Sputnik 5, the same way they rejected hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and all of this stuff. It was all part of the same thing. They were pushing us towards a particular solution, which was not to save lives. And the Russian vaccine, their rejection of the Russian vaccine was clearly along those same lines, because they had a different agenda, which was to bring in the global health passports and all the rest of it, and build their technocracy on it, their transnational technocracy on it.
Yeah.
And the Russians blew it all wide open. Now,
yeah,
and zero COVID is a weird thing. Just this, I'm going to try and like just one quick thing. From my perspective, zero COVID, I think, helps, and it is two things, or potentially two things, to other ideas to think about. One, By taking specific areas of Chinese production offline, at times, it absolutely supports their strategic partnership with the Russians in evading sanctions by putting basically effectively counter sanctions on supply chains for important goods and services, especially pharmaceuticals in the United States. Remember, with the CHIPS Act and with the Biden's big executive order and all the money starting to flow back into the United States to build a new semiconductor manufacturing industry here in the U.S., which honestly is going to happen in the next 3 years. I mean, TSMC is going to have a 3-nanometer fab in Texas by 2024.
Okay, oh, really?
So they're going to be producing iPhone chips. Hey, they just announced this last week. So This so this remanufacturing of this manufacturing renaissance for semiconductors here in the United States is a big deal. The CHIPS Act and the executive order put China behind the eight ball on semiconductors, specifically semiconductors for advanced military hardware, because that's what this is really about. And on the one hand, but at the same time, the Chinese have us completely over the barrel and for pharmaceutical precursors. We've offshored all of that here in the US. We have no strategic moat around pharmaceutical production here in the US, and we're seeing it just popped into my head. We're seeing massive shortages of basic things like Tamiflu. All of that came out yesterday. That's probably downstream of Xi's zero COVID policy, because he probably shut down all of that production. Let's take it one step further. He also has real, honest to God, civil unrest because of the Fed aggressively raising interest rates and cutting off, the Biden administration starting to start a trade war. We've got cost of capital and China is, you know, through the roof. Now they've got a real, honest to God, property crisis. So how best to stamp out potential civil unrest? Lock everybody in their homes. So in that respect, I think those may be two angles on this as well. So, you know, but it's very clear that it's both support for the Russians initially for the first 3 or 4 months of the war in Ukraine. And now it's part and parcel with, okay, well, if you're going to take chips away from us, we're going to take drugs away from you. So that's what I got.
Wow. Yeah, that's extremely interesting. I think you're on the right track. It kind of makes a lot of sense. I just wanted to add another thing since this had all been happening, I saw an interview with a Russian general on Russian TV, right? So mm-hmm. this was not, and it's like an older guy, and the woman who's interviewing asked him, and this was recorded during the pandemic period in 2020 at some point, and she asked him like, "Oh, what about what about the pandemic something?" And he just kind of said like, "Oh no, you know, this is we don't regard this at all as a public health issue. We regard this exclusively as a global geopolitical issue, the pandemic." Okay, so it wasn't. They knew what was going on. That's the thing. Yeah. They knew what was going on, and they had a strategy of how to deal with it ahead of time.
Yep.
And you know, one thing you cannot say about the Chinese is that they're stupid. They're extraordinarily sophisticated. So understanding what they're doing, you can only guess. And I think that Tom's guess is very good. It makes sense. But I think we'll find out with time if there's something more to it, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, just simply no way to know at this point.
Can I ask, when we sit here and I sit in Canada, so I look at our fearless leader and I got zero confidence, okay, zero. And we just got through the Emergency Act Commission and I got even less confidence in them. If I was sitting in Russia or I was sitting in China, do I look at my leaders the same way? I mean, Putin's got, you know, is in full out war in Ukraine. You got China, I don't think anyone can knock the Chinese look far in advance, but I'm trying to figure out if the population's there, guys, if they are going, oh yeah, we got this under control, or if they're, you know, like, we don't like what's going on with our leaders. Cause I know here in Canada, like I sit and I mean, Tom, you're in the States. I don't think you look at Biden and go, wow, we got a great rock star on the old political stage right now. I mean, half the time he doesn't know if he's coming or going. Right. But you know,
all he knows is that he's got Jell-O coming. That's all he knows.
In fairness, Jell-O followed by Jell-O followed by
that thought. We're done. Blooper reel number two. Sorry.
Well, I mean, and our leader, I mean, it's a dress up time, right? Every time he's in a new outfit with a new, just on the political stage, trying to buy into a culture, blah, 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 blah. I don't need to go any further than that. Do the populations of Russia get what's going on? The same with China, or is it no different than in Canada and the United States? Some of the people get it and other people are just clueless.
I'd say that the Russians are pretty well clued in on a lot of what's going on. And you can tell from the way the polling that's done, and you can, of course, you can attenuate any local polling, you know, depending on, you know, where it's from, you know, some percentage, 10% this way. But if you really look at Russian polling, like, they're very close to, you know, what you would consider a popular mandate backing Putin's policies, be it 70 to 75% approval rating on, you know, now it's like the war, for example, has dragged on in a way that the Russian people are actually angry with Putin for going so slow. Because the Russian people understand, and partly this is because Russian propaganda is effective at selling this as a war for Russia's survival against the West. Attenuate that as you will, right? I happen to agree with that sentiment. I would think, I don't want to put words in Alex's mouth, but I do think that Alex feels, you know, close to the same way. But, you know, I interact with people who I respect, and my partner, Dexter White, who doesn't see it that way. And so just sees it as, you know, typical kind of government mafiosi tactic stuff, right? You know, that the Russian state is no less or more a mafiosi style government than ours is or anything else. So, you know, how effective the propaganda is a good question. I, at a minimum, because Putin has competent and they know that Putin works for Russia, they can quibble with the mistakes he makes, but they understand that, you know, from what I can tell, they know that he has Russia's best interests at heart, even if they don't agree with him. We don't have that luxury here in the United States. You don't have it in Canada. And we certainly don't have it in much of Europe. And it's clear from the policies that these people pursue.
Yeah. And, you know, for people who have a big problem with Russia invading Ukraine, because, you know, there's still a lot of people who say, like, an unprovoked invasion, blah, blah, blah. It really started not as an invasion, but as a special military operation. And it is clear now that Putin never intended to overrun Ukraine. Mm-hmm. They had very specific goals. And in late March, early May, they even had very advanced negotiations with the Zelensky regime where, you know, they said, like, you recognize Crimea, you demilitarize, you continue as a neutral country, and we and you recognize autonomy for the Donbas region. And we pull all the way back out of Ukraine completely. We're done. It's over. So Russia's initial strategy was to achieve very strictly limited goals, to get NATO out of their backyard and to make sure that Ukraine wouldn't become the bludgeon that NATO could use in the future against Russia. That didn't work. Boris Johnson flew into Kiev and said, like, no, don't sign anything. Keep going. We're behind you. Just, like, let's you and him fight all the way to the death.
Right.
And so that changed the calculus. But, you know, if people feel that this is unjustified, they have to try to see it from Russia's point of view, because the Russians remember very well how World War II happened. And World War II was pretty much the invasion of Russia. It wasn't just Germany invading Russia. This was like a coalition, like a massive coalition of the willing that came together for the Operation Barbarossa and they orchestrated the biggest invasion of Russia ever, bigger than Napoleon times, you know, like something like 1.6 million troops, 3,000 tanks, 1,500 airplanes, like absolutely colossal number. The result was that at least 27 million Soviets died, 16 million Russians. Russia was completely devastated. And this was one of the worst atrocities that ever happened in history. But it wasn't a surprise, right? Germany had been militarizing from the mid-20s through the 30s. Hitler's objectives were very clear. It wasn't a surprise, like, oh gosh, you know, who knew? Everybody knew. And when King George V was put to sleep in London in 1936, and he was put to sleep, right? He didn't just die. We know this now.
Right.
When he was put to sleep, then Stalin sent General Tukhachevsky to London in 1936. And General Tukhachevsky at that time was like the rock star of the Red Army. Like, he was like the biggest name, the most
right.
He was a bigwig in the Soviet nomenclature. Tukhachevsky got together with top military generals of the British Army. He presented them what was going on in Germany in great details, because the Soviets had very precise intelligence of what was going on in Germany and the pace of militarization and the arms productions and the strategy and the agenda and everything. And he told them, look, Germany is very weak now. They're dangerous, but they're weak. It would be, we can easily go in there, demilitarize Germany, denazify Germany. And the British general told him to go pound sand. And then Tukhachevsky flew over to Paris straight after that. And he gave the same presentation to the French military brass, who were all deferring to London. Everybody was coordinating for foreign policy with London. And they were all like, yeah, you know, we just had a big war here 20 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. We don't really want to rock the boat. So nobody wanted to do it. And so this was from the Russian point of view, this would have been the ounce of prevention that would have prevented a pound of destruction down the road. Today, the Russians regard what has been going on in Ukraine since the 2014 coup.
Right.
In exactly the same way, they have a mass-scale militarization and Nazification of Ukraine, clearly with a view to use Ukraine as a proxy against Russia, to weaken it, to drag it into a quagmire. So again, Russians are like, do we apply an ounce of prevention, or do we wait, let it fester, and then have a pound of destruction? So, you know, last December, I know it's most people don't remember last December, but last December, the Russians gave it a really thorough attempt with diplomacy. They sent the Biden administration and the NATO each a very detailed treaty of what Russian security requirements were, and they wanted to diplomatically work it out. And again, the same spiel, you know, Russia, Ukraine cannot join NATO. Ukraine has to be neutral. NATO cannot set these certain ballistic missile sites in Eastern Europe, and so on and so forth. Generally, things that if NATO was just a defensive alliance, they could have said, like, cool, we're done with that. You won't attack us. We won't be a threat to you. Let's sign the thing and everybody's happy. They spat in Russia's face and said, like, what are you going to do about it? And then the Russians said, like, okay, well, we're going to take our military technical measures. And now we have what we have. So, yes. You know, anybody who regards this as Russia breaking the international laws and international norms and so forth, Russia is playing a very long game. They remember what happened in the 1930s and what happened in World War II, and they won't have it again.
Yep.
That's their game. That's Putin's agenda. That's his strategy. And I mean, for the West to avoid massive train wreck that we have now, they should have acknowledged and recognized that Russia has very legitimate concern and very serious grievances, and sort those concerns across the table rather than by this massive bloodshed that we have now. So it wasn't unprovoked, and Russia absolutely has legitimate reasons for doing what they're doing.
Agreed. No, this is such hard to get through to people, that the status quo ante of 2021 or of 2020 was never an acceptable status quo. And to then judge, this is the argument I've been having with you know, with people for, you know, almost a year now, which is that status quo is not acceptable. You can't just say, well, this is the way things were. You broke this rule, therefore you're at fault. Okay, well, that's very Western thinking. Lavrov I just read something from Lavrov yesterday talking about this very thing, saying, you know, in the context of negotiations with Ukraine, and like, look, the West has binary thinking. You are either going to, you know, fully comply with what we want, or we hate you and we're going to, you know, not talk to you anymore. We don't argue. We don't work that way. But that's the way the West works, and it doesn't matter what we're talking about when it comes to Russia. It doesn't matter if it's Ukraine, gas prices, coal deliveries, you know, prisoner swaps. It doesn't matter what it is. It is all this. It's my way or the highway. I've wrapped myself in the moral high ground, and it's very Manichaean, black and white, and frankly, childish thinking. And the Russians have accused the West of being childish at the diplomatic level now so many times I can't count. So for the most part, I've tuned almost all of the day-to-day machinations of what's going on out, because none of it's going to change, because the personnel at the top of the Western governments who are, you know, engaged in this stuff, engaged in the other side of this, aren't going to change anytime soon. The Biden administration will still be in charge in the United States. Von der Leyen and her merry band of fascists will be in charge of the EU. The British haven't changed their foreign policy one whit since the 1860s. And that's the way things are. And now we have a fully aligned, you know, king on the throne in England, who's aligned with Klaus Schwab, who is the ultimate, you do it my way or you don't do it at all, or you don't get to live. That's the way Klaus Schwab runs the World Economic Forum. Martin Armstrong's made this point publicly. He's like, I've met Klaus Schwab. I know people who work for Klaus Schwab. One of the things about Martin Armstrong is, like, you know, you can argue for or against his, you know, his computer, Socrates, and all that stuff. Even if you ignore Martin from that perspective, and that's, you salt Socrates to taste. What's important to understand is that Martin's always in the room with the people who make these decisions. He has advised every major political figure over the last 40 years. And so his contacts are impeccable. And when he says something like that, you have to listen to him. He's met Klaus Schwab. He knows what he's like. He knows how he runs the World Economic Forum. And he runs it like, you know, he runs like a tyrant. He's the ultimate control freak. And the policies of the World Economic Forum and the people that he's put in place in governments around the world act exactly the way as a proxy for him. So why would you expect anything to change on the diplomatic side? So the Russians have known this. And since there's not going to be a diplomatic solution, and for anybody listening to my voice who says, well, they can just get the hell out of Ukraine. Like, no, they can't. Because as Alex pointed out, they remember the period between 1936 and 1940 very, very well. Because the British manipulated events in order to get it to the point where they would figure out a way to get America, their overgrown colony, across the Atlantic, as the MEP from Ireland pointed out to an empty European Parliament the other day. You know, we just have to figure out how to get them involved, you know, in World War II. So then the oil embargo against Japan, which, you know, and all the hinky stuff that FDR did to create Pearl Harbor, which is ultimately in the end a false flag attack. And, you know, here we are off to the races. But, like, they're doing the same thing in Ukraine.
Yeah.
They're doing the exact same playbook, Sean. Exact same playbook as what Churchill ran in 1940.
Okay. 41. You guys, I didn't realize we were going to talk about some history here today. So I gotta know, in your thoughts on Russia. Let's stick to Russia, the 1930s. Sure. Okay. There's this guy named Alexander Solzhenitsyn, right? The Gulag Archipelago, and all the horrendous atrocities that happened in Russia. How does that factor into all this? That paints Russia as pretty much eating itself alive, right? Pulling its best citizens who think independently, throwing them in gulags, citizen against citizen, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
No one here is making an apologia for Stalin and for Russia's internal domestic policy, which is horrific. But from a geopolitical perspective,
No. But wait, to make the point precise. When you're talking about the Gulag Archipelago and the horrors that Solzhenitsyn describes, you're talking about Soviet Union. You're not talking about Russia. And Soviet Union was the creation of the West. Soviet Union wasn't in fact, you know, I spoke with Russian intellectuals who say it's not that Soviet Union wasn't Russia. Soviet Union was anti-Russia. So what happened, in case this is news to somebody, because it's now pretty much on the record, you know, there's been a lot of stuff written about this. Anthony Sutton has an excellent book about it called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, I think, something like that.
Yep.
And he shows very conclusively, based on all official sources, you know, declassified materials from the State Department, from, you know, all the Western official sources, so no conspiracy stuff. Anthony Sutton shows that the Bolshevik Revolution, the coup in 1917, was planned, orchestrated, and funded by Wall Street and London bankers. Okay, mm-hmm. Trotsky and Lenin. Lenin was a Western agent. He was sent from Switzerland to Russia on the eve of the Bolshevik Revolution. Same with Trotsky. They were sent there with suitcases worth of US dollars. And not only that, but they were able to only, basically what you had is an early version of a color revolution, you know, something similar to that happened in Kiev in 2014. Same technology, same methodology. And even at that, they could only wrest control over St. Petersburg and Moscow. Okay? They needed to get control over the whole Trans-Siberian Railway to secure the whole country. There was a whole war after that. And the United States, Britain, Japan, Czechoslovakia, Poland, all sent troops to fight in Russia and to help the Bolsheviks secure their stranglehold on Russia and to create the Soviet Union. Today, history, the historical narrative is a little bit different. Now they say like, you know, these troops were sent to help the whites to try to defeat the communists. But in actual reality, everything they did was to defeat the whites and to help the communists. And the communists were completely in cahoots with the Wall Street and the London bankers. And the whole strategy was based on the same thing. You know, like the first thing they did is they established the one central bank that for the duration of the Soviet Union, you had that one bank that issued currency and held accounts for every Soviet citizen. It was completely a Western creation. So all of the Gulag experiences and everything that happened was done in coordination with the very top of the Western parasite banking elites.
I'm glad that I asked the question, because I always conflate, fellas, Soviet Union is Russia, which you are making very clear are not the same things.
Mm-hmm. No, very different things. Very, very different things. Soviet Union is what we get if we passively acquiesce to what Klaus Schwab has in mind for us.
Absolutely. The EU is modeled on the exact same thing.
Exactly the same thing, maybe with a bit more high tech around the edges.
Yeah.
But the same exact thing. And, you know, it doesn't reflect the culture of the United States or any European country. It's just simply high tech totalitarianism. That's what it is. And the Soviet Union was low tech totalitarianism. It wasn't Russia.
Right. And when we say that, what Alex is pointing out here is something I discussed with Alistair Crook and Matt Arrett and Joaquin Flores on my podcast at the beginning of the year when the war first broke out, as we were getting ready for this. I had them all on to discuss the civilizational aspect of this, that when this is what this is, just to put a finer point on what Alex is talking about, to make this distinction. China, Russia, Iran, right? These are civilizations. The Soviet Union is a system, right? The civilization is here and the system is here. We in the West conflate these two because certainly in the North American West, we do, because our history is so short that we've only ever lived under really one system, okay? China's thousands of years old. The Russia is, you know, at least 1,000 years old. The Iranians are thousands of years old. Their cultural and civilizational imprint is Iranian first, the system we live under second. So when we're talking about what's going on with China, for example, this is why China is eternal. China, this is why China can go from being Maoist to Dengist to now Xiist, as long as it fits with the long-term goals or the civilizational goals of the people of China, they'll go along with it. When it doesn't, that's when they overthrow the system, bring in a new system, and move on. The Russians are very similar in that respect, and certainly the Iranians are. And this is a hard thing for our foreign policy types, our foreign policy wonks, to understand, because we have a particular way of viewing the world. And we think since it works the way it does where we are, and that means it must be the way it works everywhere else. This is not to say that, you know, human nature is different for Chinese than it is for Americans or for Europeans. No, everybody reacts to incentives the same way in the short term, over the high time preference behavior. But in low time preference behavior, that and the cultural imprint that exists within these societies, the imperatives are much different. So we can have regulatory capture or an oligarchic mafiosi style government here in the West and understand it, and even go along with it to a greater or lesser extent, because that's all we've ever really known. It doesn't matter if we're talking about Rome or the British Empire or the American Congress or, you know, or the Spanish kings or whatever. It doesn't matter. So, and I would even argue that, you know, you probably have the same feeling, you know, if you really push Greeks this hard, that Greece is a thing. The system that Greeks live under is a different story. And the way, you know, most Greeks view their government at this point, you know, having, you know, I would think that that's a similar analysis could be made. So there's going to be some willingness on the part of these people to, well, you know, go along with whatever crazy ideas are in, you know, happening today, because, you know, 50 years from now, it's not going to really matter, because we'll have a different system if we need a different system. because they do have enough strength of character and strength of culture to know, well, this system's not working for us. But what the West always does is to put, especially with the British at the forefront of this, is to put pressure on these civilizations that they want to colonize and take over, and force them into systems that are ab reactions against that pressure. And that's the kind, and that's why China has become so totalitarian. Okay, that's why the Russians went the route they did. That's why the mullahs in Iran are not overthrown. Okay, because no matter how much pressure you put on, Iranians, Iran is going to back whatever system is going to afford them the greatest amount of protection from these rapacious and hyper-aggressive Westerners. And then once that finishes, once that's broken, then they may, that's when we'll see the mullahs overthrown in Iran, for example. And that's when we may see a different, system emerge in China. So, that's one of the aspects of this that I think is lost in the subtlety of, geopolitical analysis. I think it's important for people to remind themselves of. China is the current Chinese CCP is evil. No one would argue that, but it may be the thing they need at this moment in time to outlast, the evil coming from the West. And I hate to put it in those terms because that's not, but that is that's as valid an analysis as any other.
Well, okay, so I'm not going to push back against this, Tom. I'm just going to challenge it because I'm not sure about what I'm going to say now. But okay. What I gather from Chinese sources, first of all, there's a lot of things that we are told are happening in China that are not happening in China at all.
Okay.
All right. Like this is a social credit system. We've all seen these videos of people walking around the street and there's these squares around their heads and something's going on. And I was like, oh my God, they have this social credit system. And then they show people with the telephones and then it turns red or it turns red, green. And then they go and this is all this evil control system. Except every source from China that I consulted said, this doesn't even exist. Where do people get that? It doesn't even exist. Nobody in China is aware of this Chinese social credit system, right?
Right.
Second of all, to call something evil, I like to go back to the biblical injunctions, you will know them by their fruits.
Mm.
So yes, you have like an authoritarian or maybe even totalitarian government system, but are they evil? They raised like, 800 million people out of poverty over the last 40 years? I think that we have to appreciate that the Chinese leadership is playing on Team China. They are doing what they feel is best long-term for the interest of the Chinese people or the Chinese nation.
Right.
We've seen that they built 20,000 kilometers of high-speed rail networks. They are plowing massive amounts of money into infrastructure. A lot of this is malinvestment, but a lot of it is really cool stuff.
Right.
So, China went from being like one of the world's poorest countries as recently as 1980s, like literally one of the world's poorest countries,
right,
to now being a global superpower.
Mm-hmm.
And this all happened under Deng Xiaoping and Xi Jinping, right?
Oh no!
So
Alex, all I'm gonna say is, and yeah, no, I won't even disagree with you about any of that at all. What I'll tell you is, I really do believe that a lot of that is a consequence of the hollowing out of the West through ruinous central bank policy, ruinous zero bound interest rate policy. And the Chinese were allowed to run a mercantilist empire for 20 or 25 years longer than they even expected to be able to do so. This is a, and I'm not, yeah, no. So absolutely. They, Yeah. Is there a lot of malinvestment? Yes. Is there, you know, remember, Alex, I'm a hardcore libertarian. Like, all governments are evil. Like, you know what I mean? Like, at a fundamental level, yeah. You know, when I use that term, I'm not, you know, I was using it in a way to work with. Even if you do believe that China is evil, everything you just said is correct. And if the Chinese government, in, you know, many ways, not laudable, but in other ways is extremely laudable. And it's not for me to judge whether or not they did it right or wrong. This is the big thing. Right. I think everybody in the West needs to get over their fucking high horse about. Like, get off that high horse.
Thank you. It's you know, the reason why I think it's very important to kind of be precise about these things is because usually, you know, the campaign of demonization always precedes worse things. You know, you always have a campaign of demonization because when you're warming up the population for a military confrontation. And I think that at this point in time, when all these rotten structures in the West are falling in on themselves, the thing that would be the savior for Western ruling establishment would be a big war with China. And nobody even dreams that they had a chance to win it, but it would be so handy to justify all kinds of clampdowns.
Agreed.
Domestically, to do away with all freedom of speech, to do away with all political dissent, to do away with unfunded liabilities, to just say like, hey, we're at war. Guess what? Your pension's gone. Your healthcare is gone. Everything's gone. It's the fault of the Chinese, and we have to go and kill them. So,
you know,
allows it allows the ruling establishment to clamp down on civil liberties in an extreme way. It's like that. It would be that kind of an emergency. It would justify any kind of anything. So you would suddenly find yourself in the Soviet Union again. And so this is why I want to be very careful when, you know, the word evil is even used, because, you know, the Chinese are Chinese leadership is accountable to the Chinese. And if they do things that are adversarial to the West, well, that's our problem. You know, like, it's like a business relationship. You know, maybe you want to sell me a brick for $1,000, but if I need a brick, I'm not going to give you $1,000 and say Tom Longo is evil. I'm just going to say, dude, a brick should cost 10 cents. How about I give you 15 cents and then you should be happy?
Right.
You know, I stand for my interest, you stand for your interest, and we have to meet somewhere in the middle where, you know, we can be at peace at whatever deal is being done. But it was the Western political elites and banking elites who have even allowed China into the World Trade Organization, most favored trading nation status. They've allowed them to blatantly manipulate their currency to make themselves the most competitive exporting giant in the world. All of this was done by people like George Soros, Henry Kissinger, you know, the elder Bush, and all of these people deliberately.
Yes,
they've done
because they thought
this
they were going
not
to be
an
able...
accident, because they knew they were gonna kill the host, the United States, and they needed a new host. The empire needed a new host and the new global cup, so they built up Russia. And now they're throwing a tantrum they built up China, and now they're throwing a tantrum because China has its own ideas about what it wants to do with the power and wealth that they got.
I'd go one step further, Alex, and say that they did it deliberately on the hope that they would be able to build the same regulatory capture, oligarch run. We control the money, therefore we control the government system that we have here in the West. They fully expected that to happen, and Xi took one look at that and went, "No." And they blew. And then I've talked about things like Evergrande blowing up, Archegos Capital. I think FTX and so many of the other systems were built in recent years in order to get their money in there, then use that to destabilize the country from within. to gain political power, to gain corruptive, to gain the control of the bureaucratic state, and then neuter basically the CCP and the Politburo. Hey, I get it. Guess what?
Exactly.
And guess what? Xi turned around and went, you know what? Your money's not good and you're last in line. And we're going to purposefully destroy all of these systems that you invested, these companies that you invested in and you think are so powerful. Yeah, now they're worth nothing. What happened to Evergrande now is what I think the Fed's doing to BlackRock, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Like that's how big I think, you know, this is what I think is going on, you know, at a fundamental level, that we're seeing a pushback against these people. It does multi-vector. It's not just the Russians turning around and nationalizing. You know, why do they hate Putin? He nationalized Yukos. He nationalized all these, you know, he put in jail all of their pet oligarchs that they had put in place in the 90s in order to run the same thing there. Guess what? All those people were either thrown in jail, had their wealth stripped of them, you know, their teeth pulled out and all of their journalist assets thrown in jail. Those journalists were all CIA and MI6. Like,
yeah.
Stop it. You know, and all that we ever do here is just sit here and virtue signal about how terrible these people are because they have control of the megaphone. And what people really need to wrap their heads around is that we have been lied to about all of this at every fucking level. And so, no, I fully understand what Xi is doing. Like, I, you know, when he put out his common prosperity platform a year and a half ago, and I read the planks of it, I'm like, oh, the guy who's going to hate this more than anybody else on the planet is Soros. And lo and behold, 3 months later, like, you know, this was 3 months after Evergrande. I'm like, oh, yeah, no wonder Soros considers Xi the devil, because Soros probably had billions of dollars stuffed in Evergrande. Like, and companies like it. And now we can't get that money out. And the money's trapped and he has no political power.
When we talk free speech, guys, you know, one of the things that's, you know, really top of mind right now is Elon Musk and Twitter.
Yep.
I mean, just this week, you know, they're talking about Apple pulling Twitter from its app store and different things like that. I mean, Elon Musk every day, single day, it seems like, is maybe one of the funnest men to follow on the planet for what he puts out on his platform now, which, I mean, obviously is driving attention to his own business, but, people say that wasn't part of the plan, having, Twitter go back to free speech, opening up everything else. Do you see it the same way?
Yeah. I think Musk taking over Twitter is part of the counter revolution. I think that I know Alex, you know, Alex and I have debated this back and forth about the Fed and the New York banks and how I think that they're at odds with what Klaus Schwab is doing because their incentives line up with this. And you know, and I know Alex, you're not fully on board with the way I see this, but every day I see yet another moment where the third rail is blown, you know, where previously taboo subjects are now all of a sudden allowed to be talked about. I just wrote an article yesterday about Georgia Maloney and that 3-year-old video of her talking about the colonial franc used in West Africa. Right? Now, how does that, like, that was 3 years old.
Oh, I thought that was recent.
Yeah, everybody thought it was recent. It's not, it's 3 years old. But so now ask yourself the question, how does that fucking thing go viral like this? Who puts that out there? Who allows that to escape containment? That way.
How did she become the prime minister after she clearly engaged in a blatant thought crime?
I because they couldn't stop her.
Tom, can you fill me in? Can you fill me in on what the heck you're talking about? I feel like I'm drowning right now.
So this one's a big one. So Sean, I'm going to blow your mind here. There are 14 countries in West Africa that don't have their own currency. That they have a currency. It's called the colonial franc, or some other, you know, uselessly technocratic term for it, that is printed by the French, is pegged to the euro, and all of these countries have the European central banks have to take their monetary policy. So whatever the European Central Bank decides is the interest rate, This is a colonial currency. That this is no different than what this is a holdup. This is an anachronism from the 19th century, for Christ's sake. And it exists here in the 21st century. And France, no one was ever allowed to talk about this thing. Nobody even knew about this thing. Like, I mean, it was crazy. I didn't know about it. And I'm one of the most, I consider myself one of the most geopolitically informed people on the planet. And when this thing like hit, and we all thought, and so there was a video of Giorgio Meloni, the new prime minister of Italy, talking about, during the migrant row that was going on back and forth, all of a sudden she holds up this, see what this is? This is a colonial franc note that the French impose on 14 West African nations, former colonies of theirs. Well, I use the term former very loosely because they still control their monetary policy. They're still effectively colonies. So France still has a 14 colony network in North Africa. Okay? The Eurozone isn't 19 countries in Europe. It's actually 33 countries because you've got 14 other countries that are all pegged to the euro. Like, it's crazy.
And these African countries get to sell their exports in French colonial franc. They get paid in French colonial franc, and 50% of the value of their exports ends up in the French treasury.
Yeah.
So that's the relationship.
It's beyond ridiculous. And so what happens? Meloni turns around and denies France one boatload of like 237 migrants from, I don't know, Morocco or Algeria, and everybody loses their minds. She's an evil fascist and she's inhuman and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh, you just took 60,000 of these people last year. We're not taking these 200. France can take these 200. Shut up. And then the French turn around, call her an enemy of France. Literally, the French foreign minister calls Italy an enemy of France. They play this game. And it's all but set up. They're trying to run the PR campaign. So when they get into budget talks with her, that public opinion is against her. She turns around and somehow this three-year-old video of her blowing open what is literally the third rail of European politics. We never talk about the colonial franc. No one. That's just not done. And she did it 3 years ago. And now this thing has gone viral and it's everywhere. And Le Monde and the BBC and Sky News and Die Welt and the Financial Times all had to debunk her claims about it in a pure like cover thine ass moment, because all of a sudden the French, like, why is the French, why are they doing this? Like it's you, all it does is it continues to speak to in my mind, the fact that Meloni has very, very powerful people helping her survive the mafia in Rome, the political mafia in Rome. And the only people with that kind of power are the New York banks and the Federal Reserve. And what I would consider patriots within the U.S. Department of Defense, the U.S. military establishment. Because remember, as my friends over at Mitdolcino, who are a bunch of Italian guys, remind me, what country has hosts more American bases in Europe than any other? It's not Germany. It's not Poland. It's Italy. The French have designs on invading northern Italy and taking parts of Italy over from. And there's a lot going on here where there's French military guys in Italian police uniforms running around in northern Italy. Like this is just real. Like the European Union is not in any way, manner, shape, or form, unified. And the need here is to completely neuter Italy so that France and Germany can run the table, because they need to, as Alex pointed out earlier, complete the political and economic integration of Europe and do away with all forms of national sovereignty. And the euro was always designed to do that. So understand that the euro was designed to benefit Germany at the expense of everybody else.
Oh, and by the way, Tom, just for the record, I actually am on board with your analysis. The only thing that I'm not at ease with, and that's nothing to do with your analysis, is because we're beyond the realm of economics and monetary policy. We are, this all goes overflows into geopolitics, into these global allegiances, not even between nations, but within the groups within nations that are like smeared all over the place. And so we have to guess at what's going on, you
Agree.
know?
Agree.
But
Alex, I was just
I
giving you the
think that
opportunity.
of all the
Honestly,
guesses, of all the
all I was going to
guesses
say,
that
all
I'm
those things.
aware of, I'm on board with yours the most.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I just wanted to give you the opportunity to, to allow yourself to, whatever healthy separation you want on this topic. Because I know this, because I mean, it's fine. And I don't have any problem with us disagreeing at the margins about any of this stuff. The disagreement is healthy and respectful. And any whatever disagreements there are, it's purely healthy and respectful. I like don't ever take it any other way. You're, dude,
All
you're
right.
one of
Yeah.
you're one of
No,
the
no, but
you're one of the few
no.
people on this planet whose opinions on all of these things I take it, I take it face value. And Mutual Appreciation Society here, I expect pushback and I want pushback from people like yourself, my partner Dexter White, and a few others who, I expect that. I want it, because if we don't do that, then I just become like an echo chamber, and I don't
Yeah.
want that either, right?
Iron sharpens iron. And I tell you what, boys, as you can tell, as I sit here and I've said five words this entire time, I'm enthralled with this discussion. It's been very, very interesting. And I think both sides, you complement each other so well. I think that's why the audience enjoys having always requesting you to come back on the show. We got a little bit of time left. And what I did was I put it out on Twitter. So I'm going to throw it to you guys. I hate to bring up a subject because I'm like, well, there goes the rest of the time and I'm not going to get through, there's all these different things. So I'm going to throw it to you guys on what you want to talk about here for like the last, 15, 20 minutes. Okay. You got the protests in Brazil. You got midterm elections in the United States. You got energy in Europe. And then I just had Basel III,
Puzzle three.
banking Basel III. So yeah, I can't even say it. So there's the four. Do you want to talk about money? Do you want to talk about protests? Do you want to talk about elections? Do you want to talk about energy? You got to give me some direction here because
It's
when we
really
start.
simple, Sean. They're all the same thing.
Well,
Alex, you go ahead, dude. You decide which one we're going to talk about, and we'll go from there.
okay. I just wanted to mention two things because Sean opened the discussion about Twitter. And then we got sidelined again. But regarding Twitter, I'm just I love what's going on. I'm only worried that Twitter doesn't suffer the same fate as Parler. That's my
Did we lose Alex? We can't hear you. He's saying time out.
Gotcha. All right. There's a clear. I'll pick up while Alex works it out.
Sure. Yep.
The situation with Twitter is very clear that because Musk has taken over one of their major control systems, that they're not happy, and there is a multi-pronged attempt at attacking Musk and Twitter and trying to take it out, and it's coming from almost every angle. The thing with Apple threatening, or at least Musk coming out and saying that Apple's threatening to take it out of the app out of the App Store, that's interesting. I don't know who's bigger at this point, Twitter or Apple. I would assume Apple, but I got news for you. Apple might find themselves, in losing people's good graces if if they take Twitter down, because look, like it or not, Twitter is only becoming more popular now that we're getting the vestiges of free speech being restored. So they have to go, they have to put the full court press on. And in moments like this, whenever they lose a battle, they always put the full court press on the next 6 to 8 weeks. It's always a shock and awe campaign with these people. They know that they have to, like, they have a limited time frame for this to be deep in everybody's head in terms of the Overton window, and then they're going to move on. And so this has to, they have to, like, put the full court press on that they've destroyed Twitter. And that's why they put the pressure on the advertisers and all these companies and everything else. I don't know that it'll work, because, you know, and it's a big deal. I'm going to give you a I don't know. There's a lot going on there. I just got some sure. notes this morning about the potential rivalry between Apple and Tesla, and because there's always the theory that Apple is going to build a car at some point. And so if Musk's baby is still Tesla and not Twitter and not SpaceX or anything else, then this rivalry between Apple and Twitter and Musk may actually be about Tesla more than it is about anything else. But that's very early days. I'm just kind of throwing it out there, and, yep. and we'll talk about that, and I'll put more color on that as time goes along, and we see what happens here.
Alex, but do we got ahead, you Alex. Back now?
Do you hear me? Can you hear
yes.
me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Awesome. My apologies. I had a call. I'm using my phone to on this call, and then when somebody calls me, Zoom just like mutes me completely, right. and I remain muted for as long as my phone is ringing. And but I use my phone anyway because the camera and the microphone are much better than on my PC. So I whatever. I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
But you know, another extremely interesting thing that happened, which is unrelated to Twitter, is that last Saturday on the on 19th November, there was a trilateral commission meeting in Tokyo. I don't know if you guys know about that. This. Yeah, it was it's an amazing thing. So it was the first trilateral commission meeting since the pandemic. It was held in Tokyo, the especially with the Asia group, but the Americans were also present. Rahm Emanuel, you know, was the delegate. And the amazing thing is that for the first time ever, they allowed press into their Asia group deliberations.
Wow.
And the only condition was that they can report on the deliberation, but without attributing statements to the who said it. So they could say, like, a delegate from the Philippines said this and the delegate from Japan said that. Well, basically, what comes out is that, and, you know, for people who don't know what Trilateral Commission is, it was co-founded by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski in 1973. So we're going on 50 years. This is the most powerful think tank in the world. But, you know, they have revolving doors between, you know, you're on Trilateral Commission and then you're supposed to give up your official position in government. But then when you're done at the Trilateral Commission, you go back into the government. And so, you know, people like Greenspan and Paul Volcker and, you know, people like that were part of the Trilateral Commission. And Trilateral Commission is the expression of the Western Empire's very architecture, right? Because it was, this is something that was already expressed in 1938 by one of the persons in the British foreign establishment cabal, Lord Halifax.
Yes.
Who said that the, you know, they envisioned the future of the empire as a combination of three blocks where, you know, Germany was being built up to be in control of Central and Southeastern Europe. Britain in a alliance with the United States would dominate the North Atlantic alliance. And then the Eastern dominions would be controlled in alliance with Japan. So for the last 50 years, the Trilateral Commission has been one of the main drivers of global geopolitics. And so this was always secretive, so that, you know, they would give press releases, they would give these very highly sanitized press conferences. But what was being discussed by the members was secret. And this time the Japanese organizers allowed the press in, and it's a mess. Everybody was on the Americans' case. They were like, you're pushing us into a big confrontation with China. Nobody wants this. The guy from the Philippines, a guy from the Philippines, they didn't name him, said that when two elephants fight to the death, we're all going to be dead. We don't want this. So it was a pretty big event, because it turns out that, you know, like, the empire is rapidly losing the vassals willing to fight for its ends. It's coming apart. So that's, yeah, I
that's
just
the best news I've heard in a long time, Alex.
Sorry?
That's the best news I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, that's amazing. I don't know where to find it, and it's somewhere. Well, I'll write a little Substack about it. If not today, then tomorrow.
Sounds good.
Pretty big.
Before we lost you, Alex, you were talking about Twitter, and you wanted a thought on Twitter. Before we moved on, do you recall what you were thinking about Elon Musk and what Twitter was talking about?
Yeah. Well, you know, I just wanted to say that my concern is that the Twitter ends up sharing the same fate as Parler,
right?
Because Parler emerged at some point during the Trump administration. I joined. It was pretty cool. It was lively, great debate, great source of news, and then they destroyed it. And same thing, you know, Google removed it from its Play Store, Apple from its App Store. Same, you know, like usual suspects clamped down and pretty much destroyed Parler. So I'm just a little bit concerned that they might have the same plans for Twitter. And I think it's absolutely abominable that a corporation like Apple would actually be fighting against freedom of speech. And I cannot even believe that there's such a large body of journalists and people in the media who are clamoring for control over free speech. Like I grew up in the communist world, right? And yep. I came to the United States when I was 17. That was in 1987. And free speech was this sacrosanct thing. It mm-hmm. was like the most important part of the Western culture, is that even if I disagree with somebody, they have the right to say what they have to say. And then I'll make up my mind whether I buy it or I don't buy it. And now it's all been turned upside down, and people who fight for free speech are now labeled free speech absolutist. And all the normies, the educated intellectuals, have now become very concerned about how dangerous freedom of speech is. I think the whole thing is absolutely insane and abominable. And I think it's, you know, I don't know who it was. Was it Ayn Rand or somebody like that who said, like, the day you lose free speech, the only next option is civil war and bloodshed. Mm-hmm. So the day you lose free speech, you've practically baked in revolution or civil war or some other form of bloodshed. So I think this is the hill everybody needs to be prepared to die on. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Twitter can be salvaged. I don't know if they're going to try to destroy it, but you know, the corporations like Apple should be punished. And I think that everybody who is planning to buy an Apple product should rethink it, because you're actually, you know, funding the people who are
great
your enemies.
Agreed. It's very dangerous, and I don't like what Apple's. I don't like this. I don't like where that's going at all. And I you know, but we have a duopoly between Apple and Google in the phone space.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, they, and it was, and if you don't think that was designed that way on purpose, you're out of your mind. And I go back to the missteps that Microsoft made, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago in the phone space. And I go, oh, huh. I wonder why that happened. Because, you know, Microsoft's inability to leverage its itself in the phone space couldn't have been just sheer incompetence.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I entirely agree that there was
there's something else going on there.
The roles were assigned.
Yes.
The roles were assigned. They were absolutely assigned. Two operating systems, two providers, boom, see ya.
Yep. You're either an Apple guy or a Google guy. There's no room for anybody else.
Well, boys, I to be respectful of Alex's time, he was the man who put the cap on us. I want to be respectful of that before, we sit and talk for a few more, because I sit here and you both know by now I can sit and like this is highly, highly entertaining, and you push my brain to go at the speed of light sometimes. But before I let you off, is there any other things that are top of mind here with a couple minutes remaining that you think the listener needs to know about, the going ons of the world? I know that's a pretty open-ended question, but what is Tom staring at? What is Alex staring at before I let you go?
We're going to know a lot about the state of what I'm framing as the counter-revolution in the United States. We're going to know a lot with the next FOMC meeting. I think it all comes down to the position that Powell's in and how much he and the New York banks that are on his side or that are supporting him, how much power he actually has post midterms, how that plays out. If he continues to push the interest rate regime as hard as he has been, I don't know that he's going to go 75. The market is finally starting to give me signs that, yeah, we're probably going to see 50 in December, maybe another 50 in January. We'll see. The three-month LIBOR market is starting to tell us that, yeah, we're going to get a slowdown in the pace of rate hikes. But reality is that in order to slow down, if not reverse what we're seeing, we have to pull all the leverage out of the system. And all the leverage out of all the systems. And I think that FTX is a part of that discussion. We never even got into all that today. Obviously, Alex and I are going to need to come back on and discuss this stuff maybe sometime towards the end of the year after, during the Christmas break or whatever. Not that I ever take a day off, but you know what I mean? Because I think that is the key to all of this. If the Fed continues to pull back on liquidity, shrink its balance sheet, shrink M2, it has the ability now with this huge move in long-term rates to the downside, meaning it's a big run in U.S. Treasuries. This is only giving Powell every opportunity here to shrink the balance sheet at its maximal rate, because he can now sell into strength U.S. 10 and 30 years, 20 years, 7 years, all that stuff that he owns, that the Fed owns the lion's share of, thanks to Bernanke and Yellen and Operation Twist and Operation Twist 2. I think that creates a very, very interesting moment where if he can finally get it through a majority of the players' heads that the Fed put is not coming back, that changes everything about everything we think we've known about foreign policy, geopolitics, and all of it for the last 50 years. Because since even going back to Greenspan, the system has been designed to have the Fed become the central bank of the world, destroy its credibility, and then move the Fed out and move us into either towards, the IMF or the Bank of International Settlements being the central bank of the world, and the Fed just being one of them. This is a very important point, because we are in a moment where de-dollarization is accelerating. The Fed has to pull back on offshore dollar liquidity, otherwise the dollar is toast. The dollar is toast anyway, but the question is it going to be the last one to die? Clearly, the globalists who have architected all this stuff want the dollar to fall first and have it be replaced with, and they've also destroyed the euro, so clearly they want to move into a different monetary regime. And use, as Alex pointed out earlier, use the cover of war with China or war with this or war with whomever in order to use, in order to, as Rahm Emanuel puts it, never let a crisis go to waste. So we foment a crisis and then we push forward. And if the Fed is using that collapse on their time schedule as on its time schedule, as opposed to Klaus Schwab's time schedule, the similar to the way Putin up the tempo in Ukraine by going first and ripping the Band-Aid off and moving into Ukraine before they were ready, that changed everything. And it left and it forced everything wide open. Again, just like Sputnik 5, they were expecting the vaccine rollout to be on their schedule. Putin moved it up in time by putting out Sputnik 5 and then releasing it to the world basically free of charge. So I'm not assuming here that there's any kind of coordination between what's going on Wall Street and in the Marin Miracles building and what's happening in the Kremlin. But there's an awful lot of smoke. But everybody's incentives align that they would be acting the are to stop what's happening. And I think that Europe is the sick man at the table, and they're fronting better cards the way I like to put it is, if this is a game of Texas Hold'em, they're fronting that they've got aces against people who actually are holding aces.
Alex, okay. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, everything that Tom just said is absolutely on point. And from my side, I have to admit that I'm mesmerized, because there's so much stuff going down. I feel that we're coming close to an inflection point where developments that are already like going at breathtaking pace are going to accelerate. You know, the EU is coming apart as we're speaking. Britain is in a massive amount of trouble, bigger than we know, I think. Mm-hmm. And Ukraine, I think, is, you know, hanging by a thread. And I think it's very close to snapping. Poland is in a massive trouble. Their economy is coming unglued. They're about to get swamped by, what did they say, up to 8 million refugees from Ukraine are going to Poland, to Germany, to, you know, it's a, and already, you know, I think in August they leaked an intelligence report from Germany that already the German townships and counties were on verge of rebellion because they could not cope with the refugees that they already have, and they got more coming. So Europe's going to be a mess. Ukraine's about to fall. It's going to be extremely interesting. So, guys, this was a great pleasure. Next time we connect, I bet you there's going to be even a lot more to discuss.
Well, as I told you last time, we'll plan for a month from the day and try and get you boys back on, and we'll see. You know, it hasn't been quite a month, and there's been so much going on. I appreciate you guys giving me time today and doing what you do, because it's fascinating sitting here to listen to you two go back and forth. Either way, fellas, appreciate you giving me some time, and we'll catch up here in a month, right around Christmas, I suppose.
Great pleasure, guys. Thank you. Thank you, Sean. And until the next happy occasion.
Yep, absolutely. Be well.